Right, we're in our series thinking together about kind of values that our culture holds highly, things our culture really cares about, and how those things in many ways just flow downstream from Christianity. That many of the things that our culture holds dearest, it holds dearest because we live downstream of Christians over many centuries. The one we're thinking then about today is this question of science. What this session isn't going to be is a kind of discussion of different ways that maybe some people think that science conflicts with faith and kind of working through each of those specific categories. We're not going to be doing that today. Instead, we're kind of stepping back. We're thinking about the bigger picture. We're thinking about science as a concept. We're thinking about the movement that is science and whether or not that as a thing conflicts with religion. There is a thesis that it does. It's called the conflict thesis, that says science and religion are basically always at conflict with one another. It's a relatively new idea, but was kind of trumpeted in the kind of late 1800s. Here's a guy called John Draper, who was one of the first to write about this. He said, the history of science is a narrative of the conflict of two contending powers. The expansive force of the human intellect on the one side, and the compression arising from traditionary faith and human interests on the other. It's quite 18th and 19th century language, but you see what he's trying to say, don't you? Science is basically, on the one side, there's these people who are willing to actually use their brains, and over here, there's these silly faith people, and they're basically suppressing the real endeavor, which is science. And if we just use our brains and throw that faith thing out the way, we'll make much greater progress. Wonder if you've heard that kind of thinking before. I imagine you have in one way, shape, or another. What we're going to see today is that could not be further from the truth. We're going to see that instead, actually, Christianity lays the firmest foundation for the scientific enterprise. My hope this afternoon is twofold, that this afternoon will bolster our faith in what we believe, and will enable us to have conversations with one another, with other people who don't know Jesus, in this area without fear. We're going to start by turning to discussion with a question to talk about. How equipped do we feel when our friends raise this question of kind of science versus faith? How equipped do we feel to answer that question? Turn in groups, either tables or those in the overflows, just turn to one another and discuss that together. Hopefully that was a helpful time just starting to talk about that. I imagine across the room, at least, there's going to be a pretty big range. Some people will think, I've thought about this stuff loads, I feel really equipped, I'm ready for the question. Others of you maybe feel completely ill-equipped, and actually, if anything, probably more than any other area, this is an area where you feel a kind of sense of fear speaking to others about Jesus, because you think, but if they're smarter than me, if they're more qualified than me, then they're going to be able to catch me out, and I'm going to be left feeling really stupid. I guess there'll be a real range of where we're at with this. My hope this afternoon is wherever we are in that spectrum, just to help us move us along a little bit, to give us less fear, more confidence to answer these questions in a way that really connects with our friends and in a way that boosts and bolsters our faith along the way. To do that, we first need to ask that question that the quote at the beginning raised, has science been suppressed? Has there been a suppression of science? I very much doubt that any of your friends have ever said, oh yes, but in the 19th century, John William Draper said. What I reckon is the more likely is your friends have imbibed that, and they've imbibed that from popular culture. We're going to see a little example of this thesis that science and religion contradict in the world of popular culture. This is Family Guy. If you don't know what Family Guy is, it's a kind of entertainment-y animation thing. It's pretty crude in lots of places. I wouldn't recommend it generally. We'll watch a clip in a second. What's about to happen is Stewie, who's that baby, has just found a device that can take you to parallel universes. Let's see what he finds.
From
the mouths of babes. Without Christianity suppressing the world, we'd be 1,000 years more advanced. So says Family Guy. But that is what a lot of people think. According to one survey, 57% of British people say that religion and science are incompatible. 57%. That means the average person that you know thinks that religion and science are incompatible. And the reason that they think that is because this story that Christianity suppressed science for about 1,000 years before scientists finally broke free, that story has been believed. For stories like that to really grip, they need a hero figure, don't they? And the hero figure of this story is Galileo. You heard the story about Galileo. Galileo realizes that the sun, not the earth, is at the center of the universe. And he starts telling people this, and the Catholic Church are not happy about it, and they lock him up and they put him in prison, and they refuse to listen to the evidence. And there is a brilliant example of science of faith suppressing science. Tom Holland is an excellent historian. Here's what he has to say about that story. That nothing in this narrative was true did not prevent it from becoming a wildly popular myth. That is just plainly not what the Galileo story is. So much of our perception, or our cultural perception, of the science versus religion debate is filtered through this Galileo lens, and that is just not what happened. Galileo, to the day of his death, was a firm believer in God. The Catholic Church had scientists within it on both sides arguing it. The data at that point wasn't clear. Galileo's thesis actually was fundamentally wrong. Yes, he realized the sun was at the center of the universe, but he thought all the planets moved around in circles around it, which didn't fit the data. If anything, the Catholic Church went with the data-led approach. But that's not the story our culture wants to tell. As they think about science religion, they think science is incompatible with religion. Religion suppresses science. We've got our hero, and it's Galileo, and that's where the church has always been doing. As an aside at this point, it's just worth noting, actually, how important story is in people's perception of things. The reason that the science being suppressed approach has won the day in most people's minds is because they've got a really powerful story to tell. An untrue story, but a story nonetheless. That's just worth being aware of. If the Galileo story is not the reality, then what is the reality? Well, it's that most significant scientists in the West over hundreds of years have been believers in God. Here are a list of kind of either believers in God or Christian scientists over the last few hundred years, and it reads a little bit like a who's who of GCSE science. Francis Bacon, he started the scientific revolution. Kepler, he kind of worked out that orbits were indeed kind of not circular. What's the word? That's the word. Thanks, everyone. Boyle, he had a law named after him. Isaac Newton, he had a lot of laws named after him. Blaise Pascal, Michael Faraday, Louis Pasteur, the list could go on and on and on. So many of the most important scientists that we learn about believed in God. And if we think, or our friends at least might say, yeah, but that's because they were back in the kind of in the ages where everyone kind of felt like they had to believe in God. In the 20th century, the vast majority of Nobel Prizes for science that have been won by people who are either Christian or Jewish, who believe in one God who made the world. The story is not of religion suppressing science, it's of most of the scientific advances have come from people of faith. People give it as a major reason for rejecting Christianity, but it is nothing of the sort. In fact, Christianity in many ways lays the foundations of science. That's the second thing we're going to see, the foundations of science. And we're using that word foundations in two different ways. Historically, Christianity laid the foundations for science. We've seen that in the number of significant scientists who were Christians. But also, and more significantly for us, I think, it lays the foundations of science because the core assumptions that you have to believe to be a scientist make most sense from a Christian worldview. We're going to see what they are in a minute, but this is brought together by a guy called Jordan Peterson. Some of you will know who he is, some of you will have no idea who he is. Jordan Peterson is a Canadian psychologist who is wildly popular on social media. He has millions and millions and millions of followers. Like, he literally sells out auditoriums to talk about how, like, crabs' mating patterns. It's slightly bizarre. But he's really popular. And one thing he does is he speaks kind of quite clearly about a lot of things. That means something he says are quite unhelpful, and he overstates things, and this is not a recommendation to go read through, watch through his back catalogue, although it's really interesting. But here is a clip of an interview he did recently that kind of went viral on social media. Here's what Jordan Peterson has to say about science and God. He's not a Christian. He's not a believer at all. Oh, sorry, Judy, just stop it a sec. Sorry. He's about to use a lot of words, some of which we won't understand. That's okay. Don't think that I understand all of them either. That's all we needed.
With the death of God, many other things die. Things you don't expect. And one of the things that dies when God dies is science. And no one expects that.
How so?
Because science as a practice is a religious practice. It's predicated on religious axioms. Well, you have to believe that there's such a thing as truth. You have to believe that the truth is understandable. You have to believe that understanding the truth is good. You have to believe that there is such a thing as good. Right? So imagine, to be a scientist, you have to imagine that, first of all, that the world is comprehensible to the human intellect, but more, that if you investigate the mysteries of the material world, that will be beneficial. Right? Those aren't scientific claims. Those are metaphysical claims. And that metaphysical claim is nested in a story. You know, and the Enlightenment types, they portrayed the scientific revolution as something contrary to the religious substrate. And that's not accurate. That's a French revolution. That's a Luciferian intellect history. It's not true. The universities grow the monasteries. That's where the universities came from. And science, as a widespread enterprise, got its start in the universities. They grow the monasteries. That's not questionable. Like if you go to Harvard or if you go to Oxford and Cambridge, it's just starkly evident. The layout of the colleges is a monastic layout. So the idea that there's some fundamental contradiction between religious belief and the scientific enterprise. There's nothing about that that's true. And part of the reason that we're losing the scientific enterprise right now is because we've unmoored it from its metaphysical substrate and it can't survive. If you're going to be a scientist, you have to put the truth above all else. Scientists are very rare. You have to believe in the truth to be a scientist. I think Dawkins believes in the truth, by the way. So he's an atheist, but he's much less of an atheist than he thinks. Lying scientists are atheists or just malevolent. Dawkins is a truthful scientist, and insofar as he's pursuing the truth, and insofar as he believes that pursuing the truth will set him free, then he's walking down the path as Christian to his core. Now, I know he doesn't like that idea, but he also doesn't like the fact that the scientific enterprise seems to be collapsing in terms of its, what we call, reliability and validity everywhere. So,
that's Jordan Peterson. Dawkins is much less of an atheist than he thinks he is. I'm sure he'd be delighted to know that. What's Jordan Peterson trying to say there? What he is saying is that for science to work, you have to fundamentally believe certain things. And those things are best understood in a Christian context. Worth saying, when he talks about the kind of collapse of science, he's often particularly talking about kind of issues around transgender and how kind of science is being ignored as trans ideology takes over. It's just worth noting that that's what him and Dawkins mean when they say the scientific enterprise is collapsing. But the bigger thing he's talking about is at the core, you have to have certain assumptions for science to work. We're going to pick up two strands, probably the two most important things you have to believe for science to work. And the first is this: the universe is ordered. For science to work, you have to believe that the universe is ordered. You have to believe there is such a thing as order, that there is such a thing as truth. And it's really interesting because whenever you talk to any scientist about kind of the order of the universe, they end up using language that basically gives this away. They talk about kind of the way the universe has been designed or made, or particularly, I guess, the most clear example is the way we talk about the laws of nature. What laws don't just appear. That is not how a law works. Here's C.S. Lewis. Men became scientific because they expected law in nature. And they expected law in nature because they believed in a legislator, in a lawgiver. Laws don't come from nowhere. They come from a lawgiver. If you are to believe the universe is ordered, that it has kind of coherence, that it makes sense, you have to believe that there is a reason that that is the case. And the best reason to believe that there are laws that are predictable is because you believe there is a lawgiver who made those laws. The first sentence of the Bible, first couple of sentences, are about God bringing order out of chaos. If you're going to be a scientist, you have to believe there is order in the universe. And at the very beginning of the Bible, it gives you a reason to believe that. If you're a scientist and you're not a Christian, you have no reason why the universe would be ordered. Why would we expect the same thing to have the same outcome every time you do it? Scientifically, there is no reason why that would be the case. The first big foundation you have to believe is the universe is ordered. The second is the universe is comprehensible. That means that we can understand it. Albert Einstein said this: the fact that the world is comprehensible is a miracle. The fact that humans can understand the universe is miraculous. Just stop and think about it for a second. The universe is massive on a scale that is just beyond anything we can kind of put into words, and yet the 1.5 kilo lump of grey matter in your head can understand quite a lot of it. There is no logical reason why that would be true. There is no logical reason that something which, compared to the size of the universe as a whole, is absolutely minuscule, would be able to in any way begin to understand the whole. There is no good reason why that would be the case if you are purely naturalistic, if you don't believe there's anything bigger than that. And yet in the first chapter of the Bible, God makes people in his image. People are made in the image of the Creator, so of course they, to greater and lesser extent, can understand the creation. The two key foundations that every single scientist needs to believe make most sense within a Christian worldview. The universe is ordered. The universe is comprehensible. A Christian writer puts it this way. She says, what do we need to fit the data? We need this. Belief in a rational creator God provides the first and best foundation for the scientific enterprise. First, because as we've seen, science grew out of Christianity. The modern scientific enterprise grew out of the monasteries into the universities, and most of its early kind of advocates were Christians. It was the first foundation, but it's also the best foundation because it actually gives reasons to believe those two. Whereas other scientists, they just have to take it on faith, I'm using that word quite deliberately, that the universe is ordered and that the universe is comprehensible. That is, if you're not a Christian, that is a faith position. Because there's no reason why either of those two things would be true. But for us, we believe the universe is ordered because it was made by a God who took chaos and made it order. And we believe it's comprehensible because there is a God who made people in his image to be able to understand the world that he has made. The foundations of science are Christian to their very core. The next thing we're going to see about science is the limits of science. Because scientists, if they're honest, have to admit that there are limits to what science can do. One thing that scientists cannot explain, in as far as the reading I have done at least, is how non-life gets to life. That step of suddenly there is not life and then the next second there is life, that moment has to happen at some point, and there is no way that that can be explained. So if you push scientists on that question, they normally end up saying one of these two things. They basically say, oh, well, we'll work out one day how that step has come. That is a faith position. That is saying we believe that humans will work it out. That is not an evidence-based scientific approach. That is just a position of faith. Or some scientists will talk about the universe having a kind of pro-life principle, that where it's kind of, whenever there's an opportunity for life, somehow the universe knows to lean towards life. That is a faith position. But it is language that people use because they realize that science cannot explain how life came to be. That is one of the major limits of science. But here is the other major limit, and I think possibly the more significant one. Science can never give meaning. Science can never give meaning. I'm going to explain what I mean by that with a little example. This is a pencil. If I ask you the question, why did that pencil hit the floor? There are two basic ways you can answer that question, okay? There's the science way, and that goes something a little bit like this. Well, there was no longer anything kind of stopping the gravitational pull of the Earth from pulling it down. So once that was kind of let go, gravity at 9.81 meters per second squared started pulling that pencil towards the Earth until it hit something that stopped. That is the science answer. And that is true. Every part of that is true, unless I've got a number wrong somewhere along the way. I'm being laughed. What have I got wrong?
No one actually knows how gravity works.
Oh, no one knows quite how it works. You get the point. That's the science answer to that question. The other answer to the question of why did the pencil hit the floor is because I dropped it. Those are two very different answers to the same question. Science can never actually get to answering the why question. It can answer the how question, sometimes apparently, but it can never answer the why question. There are so many things science can wonderfully explain. So a quote's going to come up on the screen to help us see that. Science can tell you how the universe arose. Science can tell you what you consist of. Science can generate solutions to poverty. Science can make you money. Lots of wonderful things science can do. Here's the full quote. Science can tell you how the universe arose, but not why it is there. Science can tell you what you consist of, but not what you're worth. Science can generate solutions to poverty, but not the compassion to implement them. Science can make you money, but not purchase you a meaningful existence. Science can do wonderful things, but when it comes to that ultimate question of meaning, science has no answers at all. And so when we're talking to our friends and they raise the science question, let me encourage you to genuinely engage with it and then ask the meaning question. Does that worldview actually give any meaning to your life? Do you actually live like that is true? Because I bet that they don't. No one lives like science is purely the only thing, because no one wants to admit, no one is kind of willing to say, well, I'm not worth anything, apart from whatever my cells could be sold for. No one is willing to say, yes, we can work out solutions to poverty, but we don't need to actually implement them. People don't live consistently as if science is all there is, because they live with meaning. And science cannot provide meaning. We've seen that the idea that science is suppressed is a false narrative. We've seen that the best foundations for science are Christian foundations. We've seen that science is ultimately quite a limited exercise and it can't answer the bigger questions of life. I'm going to put you guys into discussion groups in a sec to discuss this question. But before we do it, at that point, any questions of clarification anyone wants to fire back? Yes, science teacher.
No. This is a people question. Lots of Christians, would you say that's possibly actually grounded in the fact that the Abrahamic faith?
Yeah, so science obviously isn't a solely Western thing. And we need to not be kind of Western colonialistic and think we did everything. Absolutely. There were lots of great Islamic scientists. Again, same principles. They believe that the world was ordered and they believe the world is comprehensible because they believe in a God. There is obviously great science that was done out in the Far East and places like that, and they would have different principles that have led to that. And actually, if you do a detailed study of kind of how far they got in science and where they stopped and what they looked at, it is different, and there are some reasons for that. But yes, let's not claim it as a solely Christian thing in the sense that there are other faiths that hold those same core things that we need to hold, but in the West, it has been a predominantly Christian thing. Any other questions of clarification? Great. Let's go into discussion groups. How has what we've seen so far given us confidence to talk about these things? Let's do that for 5 minutes or so.
Let's get a bit of feedback going. What kind of things were you discussing? How are you answering that question on your tables?
Yeah. For those of us who can't say we're more of a scientist than our friends, it's okay, you can still have the conversation. But what were other people discussing?
We were talking about the purely neurotransmitters
in the brain. Why should we care about the brain? Yeah. Yeah. And it's where I think getting to some of those pushing deeper, as you guys are saying, like asking those questions, getting to questions of meaning is so helpful, because there will always be a non-Christian scientist who knows more science than you. There will always be a Christian scientist who knows more than them, until you go very much up to like the real top, but and then who knows who sits at the top of that pyramid. And so it's less about, oh, let's just kind of thrash out the evidence, because do you remember back in session one, we were talking about kind of the lenses through which we view the world, those worldview questions. If you come with a particular story, you will interpret the data with that story. And so it's helping to see that the story they say they live by doesn't actually match the way they live, and just helping to unpick some of those things. Anything else? Yes, Sarah. Yeah, absolutely. Don't go deconstruct people's worldviews, leave them in an existential crisis and say, see you next week. At that point, we need to then show them that something better, not just pick apart things they believe. Let's push on. We've seen the suppression of science, or the myth of it anyway. We thought about the foundations of science. We thought about the limits of science. Finally, we're going to think about the glory of science. First 3.5 verses of Psalm 19 are going to come up on the screen. We're going to read those out loud together, and then we'll think about them for a couple of minutes. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. Night after night they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth. Their words to the ends of the earth. As the psalmist sits and looks up at the sky, he sees that the heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. As he looks up, he sees all that God has made, and that leads him to reflect that they proclaim how great God is. And that is why science as an enterprise is a glorious enterprise. Because science done well helps us to see more of the work of God's hands. Science done well proclaims the work of his hands. It pours forth speech. It reveals knowledge. And so we give glory to God as a result. The more science we do, the more we are led to marvel at the God who sits above all of that. The God who made the world in this way. Here's a couple of examples. There is enough, if you get the DNA in your body, so DNA is kind of wrapped really tightly in each cell in your body. If you take it and you kind of unravel it into one long strand, that strand from just your body is long enough to go around the solar system twice. That is, like, that doesn't even work in my head. That screams there is a God who knows what he's doing behind all this, doesn't it? That those systems are so intricately created shows us there is a God who knows what he's doing. It causes us to marvel at God and how he has made us. Or you think about the kind of gravitational forces required to hold the universe together. And they say that if the gravitational forces we have were stronger or weaker by 1 part in 10 to the 60, the universe wouldn't exist. And we go 10 to the 60, we don't know what that means. That's like a 1 with 60 zeros on it. I was trying to work out whether I could kind of make each of you a 0 and we'd line up. There's not quite enough of us to do that. We could have about half of us and have 2 zeros each. That would about work. But 10 to 60 is a huge number. Here is how one person tried to help us to understand how big 1 part in 10 to the 60 is. The probability 1 in 10 to the 60 is the probability of you standing at one end of the universe with a dart. At the other end of the universe is the dartboard. And you hit the bullseye. That is 1 in 10 to the 60 likelihood. If the forces that hold our universe together were out by that much, that kind of tiny differential, the universe would just not function. And we go, how marvelous and wise is our God? It wasn't trial and error. He knew what he was doing, and he got it right. And scientists in those moments who aren't Christians are left with a choice. Because at that moment, you see just the intricate fine-tuning of the universe. You are basically left with, as far as I can tell, three options. You either go for, it was pure chance, we just got lucky. And I don't fancy those odds. That is an extreme faith position based on no evidence whatsoever. Or you go for the kind of parallel universe, multiverse type approach that either says the universe kind of kept trying to be made until it got it right, or there are genuinely multiple universes going on simultaneously and we just happen to be in the one where life was formed. And there's no evidence for it, and that is a faith position too, based on no evidence. Or you look at the fine-tuning of our world, look at the world that God has made, and you look at it and you go, it's designed by a designer. As you look at the evidence, which one of those makes more sense? I know where I land on that question. Science gives glory to God because it shows us more of his intricate and wise making of the world in which we live. Here's one final quote from a guy called Russell Calvin. He's a Cambridge experimental physicist and a Christian. He says, understanding more of God, more of science doesn't make God smaller. And that's really important because what a lot of atheists think is that basically what Christians believe in is a God of the gaps. A God of the gaps is basically this theory that science explains as much as it can, and wherever there's a gap, we just throw God in there to explain the rest. And the atheistic scientists will then say, well, what's going to happening over time is God of the gaps is getting smaller and smaller and smaller until one day science explains everything and there's no need for God anymore. Russell Calvin says, understanding more of science doesn't make God smaller. It allows us to see his creative activity in more detail. That is why science is a good thing. Those of you who are scientists, press on in your science, knowing that it gives glory to God because it shows more of the wonder of all that he has made. As Psalm 19 puts it, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. DNA declares the glory of God. Gravitational forces proclaim the work of his hands, and on we could go. Science is glorious because it shows us what our God is like. We unpicked that myth that science and religion are opposed to one another, haven't we? Instead, actually, the foundations you need for science are foundations that sit much more easily in a Christian view of the world. That there is order in the universe, and that the universe can be understood by humans. Christianity answers the questions that science's limits mean it can never answer. How do you go from non-life to life? But more importantly, why is there meaning? And what is that meaning? And science helps us because it helps us as Christians to understand more the beauty of the world that God has made. And so we can give him praise as a result. We're going to go into our groups. I want to spend a few minutes praying in your groups in the light of things we've thought of, and then we'll stand to sing to close.